Welcome to the official SBGN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, or whatever time it may be, where and when you're listening. Alex Nicely here, with Dr. Roseanne Meyer. Dr. Meyer was reared and educated in South Africa. She took postgraduate training in the United Kingdom, where she maintains an academic and a professional presence. She's based in France, however, which doesn't stop her from working part of the time in Basel, in Belgium, and finally back in South Africa as an academic supervisor for persons interested in dietetic training. Dr. Meyer's particular interest is food allergy or food hypersensitivity. Sensitivity, whichever you like, that might be more precise. And how variably such sensitivity manifests. Her concerns deal in particular with, are we recognizing such sensitivity? Are we ascribing various phenomena to manifestations of such sensitivity? And of course, how can we intervene to ameliorate or to eliminate these manifestations, which often cause distress to patients and their families? Let's talk for the first bit here about milk allergy or milk hypersensitivity. That can show up as almost anything, can't it, Dr. Meyer?
So first of all, Alex, thank you for that very kind introduction. And yes, I mean, you starting with a big allergy in terms of cow's milk allergy, and the problem that we've got both the immediate type, the IgE-mediated type, and the delayed type, the non-IgE-mediated allergy. And the symptoms overlap with lots of other, diagnoses. And to date, we don't have one specific symptom that you can say is only typical for food allergy. Even anaphylaxis, you can get to non-food items. So cow's milk allergy, whilst it presents in early childhood and it's one of the most common food allergies, we still see it as a challenge to diagnose, and particularly when we're thinking about the non-IgE-mediated allergy, or we call it also the delayed type allergy that affects the gastrointestinal tract.
That can manifest as anesophagitis, sometimes with eosinophilia, or also even with constipation. What are the other manifestations?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So it ranges from vomiting, feeding difficulties as a presentation due to vomiting or abdominal pain, poor growth, diarrhea, blood in the stools, and you're right at the other end, constipation as well. But we see as an overlap between all of those very typical symptoms as that these children present with severe abdominal pain and discomfort. They are quite unhappy children.
How does a clinician start to unravel these many threads in one skein of yarn?
So like with any diagnosis, the cornerstone is a good clinical history. And we always say it's an allergy-focused history that needs to occur, which then guides you to your differential diagnosis. I'm going to start here again that when you have reactions to cow's milk, for example, that occur within an hour of the consumption, you immediately direct it to more an immediate reaction. And for those, we do have tests available. So the skin prick test or the specific IgEs, and the sensitivity and specificity are pretty good of those tests. But if you have not got the privilege of getting those type of very easily identifiable reactions, and you have abdominal pain, you've got diarrhea, and let's say poor weight gain, then you're sitting with a whole host of differential diagnoses. Then the next step would be to do a dietary intake history, which often helps. The benefit is that these are conditions that appear in early childhood. So most of the children that present with a cow's milk allergy in particular do not have very complex diets. So you can often trace it back to say, okay, they've had yogurt or they've had milk for the first time, and then their abdominal abdominal pain occurs. And then your last step is when you really think you suspect a cow's milk allergy, any other food as culprit food, you need to do an elimination diet. And that's 4 weeks of elimination and then the reintroduction. So a disappearance of symptoms and the reappearance with the reintroduction. It's a long pathway. The only exception to that rule, as you talked about, the esophagus is eosinophilic esophagitis, which has a very specific diagnostic criteria, which is endoscopy-based, where you look at eosinophils per high power field.
Well, that brings us back to one of the articles that you recommended, which has to do with how to approach cow's milk allergy, diagnosis and rationale for action against cow's milk allergy, DRACMA, milk elimination and reintroduction. So really, Koch's postulates, which is that you identify an agent, remove it, and then reintroduce it. And if the reintroduction produces the same effect as that originally observed, then you say, yes, we know it's cow's milk that's doing this. But with cow's milk after elimination and with reintroduction, sometimes this sensitivity is lost. How does that develop?
Alex, you know, that is a really excellent question, because for us and for also the child, that means the health system, and also for the quality of life for a child, we want to work towards achieving tolerance earlier so that a child and a family can expand the diet. And for the last 10 years, that is where a lot of research has focused. Cow's milk allergy is really an excellent example. So first of all, we have to say that prognosis overall for cow's milk allergy, whether it's the immediate type, so the IgE-mediated, or the delayed type, the non-IgE-mediated cow's milk allergy, the prognosis is actually relatively good, which means that most children outgrow this allergy. The question is at what age and what impact on the quality of life of the families. So there are two modalities that we've used over the years. Firstly, there is the oral immunotherapy, which is relatively new when it comes to cow's milk allergy, or we've looked at using a ladder approach. When I talk about a laddered approach, I'm talking about starting off with baked milk, where the epitopes of milk through high heating have been changed from the conformational epitopes have been changed so that it becomes through heating much more tolerogenic. And that would be including, for example, a muffin and moving from a muffin that's baked at 180 degrees in a wheat matrix, moving up to then cheese, for example, then yogurt. And you can see the processing reduces as you move up the ladder, and therefore inducing tolerance in that way. The data has shown that if a child can tolerate baked milk, for example, and by the way, the data is there for egg as well, their development of tolerance is remarkably faster than if a child is just kept on a milk elimination diet. So we really invested now in very early on identifying children who have do not have severe reactions, and having those with IgE-mediated allergy have a supervised baked milk challenge. So that is under supervision, they have that, and then continuing baked milk at home, which then induces tolerance much faster. And those with non-IgE-mediated allergies, what we do, we start them much earlier on the milk ladder, so baked milk, and then we move them up from baked milk to cheeses, to yogurts, to milk. The reason why you have the supervised versus home introduction is that with IgE-mediated allergy, you always have the risk that you worry about a severe reaction. That's why for IgE-mediated allergies, for cow's milk, we do a supervised challenge where there are nurses, doctors, and staff around. And for non-IgE-mediated, which are, the symptoms are primarily gastrointestinal, they can do it at home because symptoms are not life-changing. So that has really changed our practice, and the evidence is looking very good in regards to tolerance developing much earlier and children outgrowing their allergy much earlier.
I have a trivial question, but one that intrigues me. A muffin. At what age can a child handle muffin?
Great question. So we start introducing finger foods, and we actively do it from 6 months of age, because that is when a child can actually midline, so bring a food to the mouth. There are some variations in terms of, development. But to be honest, as a dietitian, there are lots of ways to get around it. For example, I soak the muffin in their porridge. It's the same principle. As long as the muffin has been baked beforehand, your tolerance induction, because it's been baked at 180 degrees, whether it's mixed into the porridge in the morning or whether it's eaten as a muffin, is exactly the same.
That sounds like a substantial advance in food allergy and tolerance induction. And once the disorders are recognized, of course. But now we need to talk about extending the principle of diets that are immune-sparing or immune-supportive away from cow's milk and toward other antigens or potential antigens. Tell us a little bit about the immune-supportive diet.
You touch on a very hot topic here, and it's one that we have focused on over the last 5 years. I want to give you a little bit of background before I launch into the immune supportive diet. In 2017, the Alarmin hypothesis was developed by Pete Smith, and what I mean by that is that certain foods, and in particular foods that are highly processed, ultra-processed foods that are fried, for example, high in sugar, typically your junk foods, have been shown to create alarmins. So alarmins are molecules that are released by the body when there is tissue damage or cell damage. And we have noticed through the research that when you consume certain foods, these foods mimic alarmins and the body responds with a cytokine response, as if it's in an inflammatory response. So at that stage in 2017, it was just a hypothesis. In 2024, we have much more concrete data around ultra-processed foods in particular. And I want to also explain what is ultra-processed foods. So ultra-processed foods would be foods that are composites and mixtures of lot of different ingredients that you would not be putting together naturally in your kitchen when you are cooking, for example, your vegetables, or when you're cooking your meats or your fish. So they have ingredients that are stabilizers, that are colorants, that are taste enhancers, that are aimed to increase the shelf life of the products. So the impact on the immune system is now much, much more established, and we now know it affects the tight junctions within the gastrointestinal tract and leads to the transfer of the protein, which is not a desirable effect, especially if you've got a young infant that can be still prone to developing allergies. So based on that, we have cast the net out not only to the ultra-processed foods, but as you know, there are foods that have a supportive effect, whether that's related to the microbiome, and a typical example is your fruit, your vegetables, your whole grains. It's an old message, but we now know also through the improvement of the microbiome by having a big diversity of fruit, vegetables and grains, you improve the immune system. And not only that, we know you get other ingredients like the antioxidants, for example. We've also recognized the omega-3 fatty acids, for example, within that. So within a publication, we've come out with a narrative review already hypothesizing what such a diet would look like based on some of the data that we already have. It is an old message, but hopefully a message that we can reinforce to say have more freshly cooked foods have 60% of your foods as fruit, vegetables, whole grains, plant-based proteins as well, and reduce the ultra-processed foods and reduce the sugars. That's not only a message that fits in with being immune supportive from an allergy perspective, but also cardiovascular diabetes and also long-term health from that perspective.
What steps are being taken to... Well, empirically, one runs into questions of placebo effect and so on and so forth. What approaches can be taken to test the utility and test the applicability of this diet, and are they underway?
It's a great question. So because of the pathophysiology of certain allergic conditions being better established, and I'm going to use eosinophilic esophagitis, that's where, though, the... pathology and diagnostic criteria has been best developed. That's also where we have models proving the impact of, for example, ultra-processed foods on your immune system the best. Here we have, in particular, two centers from the Dutch center and also from the Italian side doing a lot of work. So Roberto Canani has done the model on EoE where they've actually looked at the endoscopy biopsy results and have exposed to ultra-processed foods and can see the change in the Th2 responses, so which is a more allergenic response, to drive inflammation. So we have that in vivo model to show that you can see an inflammation increasing. What we also now have is the Dutch group in an EoE patient cohort looking at groups that have an immune modulatory diet where they've reduced all of the ultra-processed foods, increased fruit and vegetables on top of their dietary elimination versus the traditional approach where you say, okay, just eliminate those foods. Don't think about, you know, which alternatives you go. And they've been able to associate the eosinophilic count that they have on repeat endoscopies with an association with those patients that have had the immune modulatory diet with less ultra-processed foods, more fruit and vegetables, have a lower eosinophilic count versus those that were just on the traditional approach where you say, just eliminate the foods, don't care about what alternatives, had a higher eosinophilic count. And it's in the infancy, so I would say to you, numbers are still small, but that particular group has now prospectively recruited a bigger number. But I think the preliminary data in vivo and now starting to come in vitro is looking quite promising.
Is this also being carried out in patients who suffer from constipation?
Alex, that's an excellent question around constipation. And the answer here is that allergic dysmotility disorder, so both at the bottom, so the constipation, and at the top, the gastrophageal reflux disease, by many of the allergy societies, is still not recognized as an allergic condition that can present because of food protein. In Europe, we are leaning to recognizing it. So the European Academy has recognized it. But the reason there's the controversy is that the pathophysiology has not been well established. And because the pathophysiology has not been well established, to have therefore a mechanism established for ultra-processed foods or the immune modulatory diet and the impact is going to be really difficult. So at the moment, the research has really focused on allergic conditions like EoE, but also asthma and eczema and IgE-mediated food allergy, where your pathways and your pathophysiology is much better established so that you can understand the mechanism.
I take your point, and I understand that. Let's go back to the skepticism with regard to constipation as a manifestation of food hypersensitivity. What else do these skeptics have to offer as causes for dysmotility? What else are they postulating?
That's a very good question. I think at the moment, answer that I normally get when I challenge based on some of the research that has been done is that it's most probably related to functional constipation, dietary reasons, but it can't be a milk protein. I'm a believer, as you can hear, because I have colleagues that have done endoscopies where they infuse the milk protein to a specific area and then take the biopsy from that area. And you can see the mast cell degranulating around the area and wrapping around the nerve cells, then impacting on the motility. I think the problem here is, Alex, and that is what many healthcare professionals are, against it and saying that constipation and vomiting or reflux is such a common symptom in infancy or pediatrics. And as you know, now called disorders of gut-brain interaction. So if you look at overall worldwide, between 20 and 30% of infants present with constipation or reflux at some point during infancy. And it's seen as a normal progression of gut maturity that we will still need to do quite a lot of research to show cause and effect.
And yet here we have an article that you've placed very recently for the European Academy for Allergy and Clinical Immunology on diagnosis and management of food allergy-induced constipation in young children. That reads to me as if people are coming around to your point of view.
We are hoping so. We're really hoping so, Alex. And you'll see in the publication, we are also providing different mechanisms that we're proposing with some data that has been published as well. So we are hoping people are getting around. What we are not disregarding is to say there are, of course, other mechanisms for constipation as well, including the dietary pathway, and there are other conditions that can lead to constipation. But we are also prompting healthcare professionals to think about allergy if normal treatment modalities have not had any impact.
I take your point, and I hope that listeners at home or in the car or in their office will take the point as well. Roseanne, Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for making yourself available for this podcast recording. And I've come away from it with a greater appreciation of how much progress indeed has been taking place in assessing hypersensitivity reactions, their manifestations, and what to do about them. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me to talk about a topic that I feel very passionate about.